The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Oh, and welcome to Deep Cuts. How are you doing this morning? You look like you just got out of the shower.
I did. I got to go straight to work as soon as we wrap because we're on funny times because you're in Canada and I'm drinking a lot of coffee.
Same, but it's ready like, to roll. Oh man, is it like 8 o'clock your time? I just realized.
No, it's nine.
Okay. I was going to say you got up early for me.
Well, you said 8:30 and I said 8:50. 8:50 is me like struggling to the second to be ready in time. I mean, I can wake up and do that, but I have 5 to 10 things that have to get done, you know, before I'm out the door. So I'm like, boom, boom, boom.
I've been up.
Coffee is the most important.
6 a.m. Canadian time, like my central time. So I've been up for hours. I cleaned my whole apartment already. It's great.
Well, there's nothing there. You're in an empty space. It's like a bottle of water behind you. That's all I can see.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, that's actually hand soap. Okay. But it stays there. But that is kind of the crazy thing. I am so used to having two kids and two dogs and two cats. And then suddenly it's just me. The way that I shop, the way that I live, I clean up when I spill things and then I don't have to think about it again.
It's nobody, like you're in a monastery.
I know. Nobody like spills goldfish and just fucking kicks them under the couch. Yeah. So it's like, oh my God, this is like, I did it in an hour, my entire
life. I assumed
place.
That was you back in the day. I was like, he's the one.
It was. Yeah. No one has stuck Skittles behind the chair. It's kind of amazing. I miss my dog. I will say I deeply miss my dogs and kitties. The kids. Yeah, I guess too. So yeah, but they're coming to visit next week.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Well, I got nothing new. Nothing's happened in America outside
nothing,
of the obvious.
Nothing
it's just
at
the boring
all.
Shit. The stuff you see on TV is all that I know of. So
I don't know. It's been kind of exciting to, I won't call it exciting. I'll call it definitely unnerving to be here. Yeah. And every time I log in to like NBC, it's like a new dumpster fire. I am like one breaking news away from just staying here.
Yeah.
Because every single time I log in, it's like a red banner they put up at the top of their website that says breaking news. And then it's like the worst thing you can ever imagine. Bill Gates
how news
all
goes
over
now.
The Epstein list. And then I'm like, what the hell? Yeah. So it just feels like, you know, dumpster fire after dumpster fire. But I get to come back to that in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Well, you still got a month to go, don't you?
Yeah, I do. So, yeah, so 4 weeks.
Well, let's jump in because I do have to. I will jump in because this is important to point out why we have officially been doing this too long. This is how I know that I've been doing this too long. I went to trivia last month and won a movie called Death Screams on Blu-ray, and it was real fancy. And I was like, man, this looks like pretty cool. It's an Arrow film release. I was like, I've never even heard of this one. You know, and I'd heard from people that it's not great, but I was like, you know, I was excited. So I went to my friend's house this weekend, Dick, and we watched it, and it's not great. And 45 minutes into the sloggy, nothing happening movie, Dick just goes, what the fuck? You logged this as 2.5 stars 5 years ago. And I was like, what? I've seen this? I've never seen this. And I had no memory, not even a shot. Well, maybe the opening shot, there's two people having sex on a motorbike. And it was like, that kind of rang a bell before somebody's killed. The rest of it, not a single I can't come remember another movie where I don't even remember a shot from it. This was like a big nothing. So obviously this is pre or right during the pandemic. I must have watched this.
Now I have probably to see if I've seen it.
Probably
I've
also done on this, a shitty DVD too, you know.
I've done this with a couple of giallos, especially because they all have like six different names where I'll start watching it. And then as I log in, a couple of the really dry Hammer films as well, where then I'll log in and I'll be like, wait, I saw this like 5 years ago.
Oh, no, but usually you work it out. I did not work this out. I would have gone the whole movie thinking it's a new movie. And Dick's the one going, you logged this. Like you
get, so it's great.
It was 2.5 stars 5 years ago, and now it's 2. So the beautiful Arrow released, dropped it by half a star, sadly. Look, it's got its regional charm. It's definitely one of the regional slashers, but there's a couple of funny things about that I've never really seen in a movie. So here I finally deduced. I always thought that people in a slasher movie like Friday 13th, the reason they broke off into couples was because then you get more little sequences.
You got to separate them from the group so you can kill them. And then it becomes like, oh, well, where's Johnny and Beth? And,
That's what you thought. Yeah. That's what everyone thought until this movie where they don't separate. And it's just a wide shot of 10 people walking around. Now, if you have 10 people in a shot, it is very difficult.
That's a lot of coverage that has to happen.
Well, actually, it's the opposite. Just one shot. Evidently, there's no coverage, just a shot of 10 people. So it keeps them, I think it's 8 to 10 at almost all times. And they're always in the frame in the woods. And they eventually, some people break off, but for the most part. And I'm like, oh, this is why you can't have multiple people in a frame, because it's very dull to watch a frame with people standing around. Kind of terrible. So this is a North Carolina regional. I would say it has less story than any movie I've ever seen. It has little bits of story that find it, like sneaks in because of extras probably who bring pathos to their extra role. But the actual story of the killer is not only never explained why the person's killing in the first place. It has this quick flashback when the killer is revealed at the end, and it's so fast that literally I don't think a person on earth, and every review I went online afterwards, everyone's like, no idea what this flashback, like, what is the memory? And I kind of built a theory in my head, but I'll have to keep it to myself, evidently. But man, so it's just people being killed by a river. It's North Carolina. And then there's some fair. There's an old lady who talks to her daughter, and it kind of jumps around who's the lead characters. So you're not actually sure who you're meant to care about.
You also haven't strung together a plot yet. You've strung together vignettes.
Yeah, there isn't really a plot. Like, they get together and go to a fair, and these are 20 somethings. Like, they are the only positive, and I do mean it is a positive, because at the start I was like, wow, all the girls in this are like all attractive. Like, usually it's like a weird mixed bag. Mm-hmm. Turns out the producer interview afterwards, yeah, so we made sure we got playmates into the movie. We had a relationship to somebody who knew playmates, so of course everyone has that kind of X factor, to a fault too. But they are going to this party, then they go to the woods to party. And what's fascinating, and I'm trying to think of other movies that do this, they don't know, and I mean everyone, nobody knows they're in a horror movie until the last 10 minutes. It's at the 10-minute mark that the first thing is seen by the characters in the movie. So we've seen a couple slashings through the whole movie, and there's a sheriff running around in the background, but at no point do these characters have any clue, and then suddenly something happens, and so the last 10 minutes, they're all in a house, because it's also called, like, Death House or something, and suddenly they are, but it's, you never see the killer, you just see a big blade, it's kind of awkward. A couple good kills, there's a couple cool things in it. Like, it's not a terrible, terrible movie, it's more just like, huh, one of those movies where you're like regional slash. And then in the interviews on this disc, the guys keep talking about how they've made this cult film and how there's all this demand for it to get released. I'm like, I forgot it twice. I forgot your entire movie existed two times.
So now that you've seen it twice, do you have the full psychology behind it?
No, but I because of the little flash. I mean, even the last line, I think, of the whole thing is somebody goes, why do you do it? And the sheriff just goes, no, I have no idea. And then it just ends. and you're like, huh.
I feel you, Sheriff.
Yeah. Anyway, Death Screams on Arrow. It's a must buy. It's I kind of am glad I got to see it a second time, because obviously it didn't stick with me the first time. But I did not necessarily think it was all that strong. It is just curious, because it happens so fast, the final reveal and the kind of last 10 minutes of slasherness. A couple good effect moments, but not the cult classic that they might claim, in my opinion. But for North Carolina completionists,
maybe that's it. Like, for a regional thing, this might be big. They might run it at a drive-in every year and have Death Scream Fest 2026.
Look, a movie like this coming on at midnight as part of my all-nighter going somewhere, I'll always enjoy it. It was just like, there's something about the whole act. It made for a pretty interesting. When he said that I'd seen it, it really was quite funny because I was like, I do not remember that, and maybe this is a bad sign. So that's Death Screams, 1982. Don't miss it.
Wow. Okay, well, I'm going to start with what was probably the best film. This was by far the deepest deep cut I'm going to cover. This is probably one of the deepest deep cuts I'm covering in many, many months. But it was also bleak as fuck, and I don't know how I made through it. So I'm going to start here just so I can get this out of the way. And this is Dead Man's Letters. Now, I mean, from the title,
I've seen a picture of it before, but I don't like a, it looked like a Soviet type thing.
Oh, it is a Soviet type thing. This is so Soviet. This is the most Soviet thing that ever existed. This was recommended to me. I have a Russian producer. And after I had been talking about how I'd watched that Russian vampire film last week, the Russian vampire family, which was another Soviet film. That one was 1990. He was like, okay, well, if you're doing your Soviet era deep cuts, you got to find Dead Man's Letters. This is much like Vampire Family, not found anywhere. I had to go to some skeezy Russian streaming site to find this because there is nothing. I couldn't even get this one on YouTube. So fine. Bowels of the internet. I'm scraping the web to find Dead Man's Letters because it has a 4.1 on Letterboxd. And I'm like, this is actually like a really good film. This isn't some like skanky, like 2 point, you know, thing with a lot of zombies and boobs that I'm looking for. I'm looking for like an actual, like really good film. And everybody was describing it as an art film. And so I was like, okay, I'll dig. And then even more so because the description kind of sounds like Stalker. And the guy who made this, Russian director Konstantin, I'm going to say this so wrong, Labushansky, made this. And he was...
Wait, so he's Italian?
Possibly.
The pronunciation sounded Italian.
Doesn't it though? So wrong. So wrong. He's Tarkovsky's assistant. He was the assistant on Stalker and ended up like training under Tarkovsky. And so I was like, you know what? Okay, fine. If that's where he's pulling influences on, I'm in. Let's do this. So I find it. And what this is it feels visually and pacing wise very influenced by Stalker. It is definitely kind of a lo-fi look. The world is super distorted. It feels kind of Begotten-esque or possibly like a Lost Apex Twins video. So filming-wise...
Is it color or black and white?
It's a little bit of both. I think the version I watched was mostly black and white. It's an interesting color-y mix. I'll say mostly black and white. But I was watching a really grainy version. So that might also be my fine Russian streaming site. But yeah, I was watching a super lo-fi version. It is set in Cold War, kind of like post-Cold War. Like you can tell that they are directly, this is 1986. You can tell that they are deep in Cold War, except this is in a post-nuclear world. Like the whole world has been completely decimated and everybody has to live underground in these bunkers and they can't go outside without full protective clothing and gas masks, like head to toe, like nuclear gear. We have destroyed the world and the world is a desolate landscape. And our protagonist is a man clearly dying from radiation poisoning who is writing letters to his son, who we also get is most likely dead. And so he's writing letters to his dead son and it's him exploring the world. And there's a scientist, he's a scientist. And so he's talking about like what happened and how he hasn't seen his son since the attacks and how much he misses him. And then occasionally he'll put on the gear and he'll go meander around the wasteland. Eventually he finds a hospital full of sick children around Christmas time, and he tries to bring Christmas to these sick kids. This is all biblical allegories and depression. And oh my God. So like in the States, you know, we're all feeling the effects of the Cold War and the scare of nuclear holocaust. We bring in Steve Guttenberg and we make the day after. Sure. This is like the Russian equivalent of that. It is so much bleaker and hard and edgy and no hope. And holy God, what the world is shit. It's all shit. We're doomed and it's shit. That said, yeah, this was fucking brilliant.
It's a Christmas movie.
And it's a Christmas movie. I never need to watch this again. If you thought Threads was just a little bit too cheerful, Dead Man Letters is for you. So yeah, absolutely beautiful. Oh my God, this was fucking amazing, and it absolutely crushed my soul for several days on end. Do I ever need to watch this again? Oh fuck no. Was it worth the hunt? If you can tolerate this, yeah, definitely go in for it. Dead Man Letters, 1986.
I'm surprised you can watch that stuff while you're filming and not affect your filming.
You know, I have to be doing something different at the same time. So this is the type of stuff that I will watch while I'm, you know, ironing or sitting here, like, you know, reading emails or something like that. Like, I can have it on, but I can't submerge myself in it. This is something that if I had seen it in the theater, I admittedly would have left because it's so heavy. I can't fully submerge myself in it. But
that's the best way for these movies.
I know. I know you can do it, and you go see these things in the
theater bleak stuff,
all the time. No, I can't do it. Apparently, he tried to make this for multiple years, and that it kept getting censored because it was showing kind of, you know, Russia in the, you know, what could happen if Russia didn't play its cards right. And there was, this was Soviet at the time. And apparently he was even confronted by the KGB multiple times and potentially arrested for creating anti-Soviet literature. And so with that, you know, this film is also kind of badass punk. So it's intense. So I say that, you know, Yes, this film is great. Oh my God, the history behind this is awesome. Go in, you know, make sure that you're feeling in a good mood when you're going in, because you're not going to be when you're coming back out. Dead Man's Letters.
I do miss Russian cinemas. I think they're some of the best at making movies, even when they're doing it under like oppressive government. Somehow they were just always formally incredible. So, very different from Russia is a guy who probably should have been locked up for all he did to the final version of Night of the Living Dead. That is offshoot Romero regular John A. Russo, the co-writer of the original Night of the Living Dead, who made any money he made after that for the rest of his life off of things to do with Night of the Living Dead, and not usually of high quality. But one of his films, I really liked, he wrote The Majorettes, he didn't direct it, and I really liked The Majorettes when I saw it a couple years ago.
Oh, that's a
but
fun
there was
one,
always one that I really liked the cover. Yeah, it's fun with the girl, the team of, what do you call that? No, they're majorettes.
They're majorettes.
That's the word for it.
Yeah. With the baton.
That's not saying I was that familiar with. Yeah. He had directed one that I always liked the cover of it because it was like a zombie looking face and a thing saying Midnight. And it's just called Midnight. Unfortunately, there's also 100 other movies called Midnight. This one's from 82. And this is just pretty vile and depraved and pretty gross from start to end. I mean, also very watchable. And again, if this was part, like, it's funny, I saw this before I watched Death Screams, and I find this to be actually the more interesting. This would have bumped it up a little bit because at the time I was watching, I was like, oh, this is just kind of gross. Anyway, it starts with, I'm laughing, even though what I'm about to say is the opposite of what you should laugh at. So it's a young girl who is confessing to a priest that she had been, you know, intimate with her boyfriend. She comes home, and this big old cop is her stepdad, played by a very famous alcoholic, Lawrence Tierney, who's the old guy in Reservoir Dogs, for those who don't know. But before that, he was an incredible actor in the 50s, but he probably was the biggest alcoholic in the history of Hollywood and probably got into more trouble on sets than anyone else, was more or less, you know, blacklisted from the industry for a long time. Quentin, in fact, even fired him off Reservoir Dogs by the last day. He comes in, and he's trying to ask her to take her clothes off just so he can see. And don't worry, I'm just your stepdad. It's real gross. Like, I was just watching going, oh, and it's also on the nose. Like, that's the thing about incest and things like this. If they're executed well, you can still be grossed out, but like, at least watch it. This was just like also executed poorly. So it's all very clunky. Anyway, she is smart enough to get the hell out. He was also drunk. You know, the cop's drunk, but then you can't help but wonder if the actor's drunk. She gets out. She goes hitchhiking. She gets picked up by two dudes in a van who are cool. They're actually nice. One black, one white, only relevant because this is a Romero riff, and they are going to go into the, I assume, the South, and there's going to be some political things based on that. They go into a bar, and all the rednecks are telling them to get out, and really quite rough, like how they speak to the black actor in this. And just, you know, I know it's part of the world, but there's some movies where it feels grosser than others, and something about Russo. Russo lacks any subtlety that Romero, to me, is one of the greatest at poking satire and sticks at things without making it feel ham-fisted somehow. Russo is the opposite. So anyway, they're all going along together. But at the opening of this movie, so this is all coming a little bit after, but in the opening, cold open, it is like a totally different movie. It's like a regional horror from the 70s where basically a woman is running away. No, she's a girl, a little girl. She gets her leg caught in a bear trap and she's screaming. And we see an old woman and her three kids running to help her. And they get there and they're like, finish her off. And then they smash something on her head. These kids take her back to their house and then do a satanic ritual and stab her in the chest. And I was like, whoa.
What?
Like, so that movie got me. Like the opening, cold opening, I was like, I'm into this. And when they're kids, now we got cut back to, it's obviously been, they never have a time lapse, but now those kids are now fully grown adults. And we don't know what's happened to their old mom who clearly was filling their head with, there is like, everyone's a monster inside. Don't trust that they're human. Like, so they're all kind of brain rotted, which is interesting. That part of the movie I thought was really interesting. Then their storylines start to intersect with our characters who are kind of running away, and it becomes kind of like big hillbilly cult movie where they're being abducted, put into like weird little cages. The woman, at least, the men are just being killed savagely. And two of the kids from the past are now dressed as cops. And the one cool thing about that is one of them is John Amplis, who is one of my favorites from the Romeroverse, and that's Martin. Mm-hmm. He's one of the cops.
Oh, he's so good.
Yeah, he's
good. At least in Martin.
Yeah, Martin. He's often pops up in Romero films, but he's one of the cops. And everyone's unlikable. Everything's gross in this movie, like kind of despicable. And it ends up being kind of like, but it's like literally three or four different movies. Then the least likely scenario is who is going to then try to save her by the end of this movie? It's her pedo stepfather, drunk Lawrence Turney. The cop is going to track them down.
Wait, and now what?
You're like, I don't know if I want her to get saved. Like, she might be better off being ritualized killed then going back to that, and so I won't say how it all ends, but it's interesting. Like, it's a cult movie. It's one of those movies that's always, you know, you always see the cover and stuff. It definitely screams, this is a tape you bought off the back of Fangoria back in 1987. like it is almost the definitive one I think of when I think of that. And so it's weird that I went all this time without having seen it. I won't say I liked it, but I am still reading Partially Devoured, that we're going to talk to Dan Krause soon. And I as I was watching this, I was like, he's either going to give this 4.5 stars and have loved it because of the connection, or he won't. And he gave it 2. So but I wrote to him saying, only a coward would do what you did and write a whole book on Night of the Living Dead. A real man would do that same thing for this movie.
Oh. Because
this movie is so fascinating that you could probably come up with a book of like, why does this exist, basically? And all the different, and I guess it was based on a book that Russo wrote. And then he adapted it himself.
This is a book? Okay.
I guess it's a book. So look, it's definitely going to have its fans because it is just, it's quite nasty and kind of amateur at times, but other times, Savini did come and help him with the effects. There's some good, couple good beheadings and things like that. It's just, it's kind of gross. Again, it's maybe save it for a big screen surprise watch and an all-nighter as well. All my movies this week are kind of in this category somehow. It just kind of worked out that way.
You went skeezy.
Yeah, this one I saw first and kind of lowly rated. And now after I watch everything else, I was like, maybe I like this more than just because it is crazy, at least. Whereas it's nothing memorable for me with Death Screams compared to this one. But that's Midnight, John A. Russo, 1982.
I just looked and most sites don't even define it as horror. It's just called exploitation, which always tells you something.
Yeah, it's somewhere in between like a cannibal redneck zombies and Texas Chainsaw and through the Romeroverse. You know, it's kind of the almost.
Okay, let's see. Where on earth do I go? You know what? I've got 2 found footage. I'm going to save them for the end. So I'm going to take us to the one that I had not planned to enjoy the most, but I probably enjoyed the most this week. And that is Dance or Die from 1987. This is an SOV film, so go into it knowing that. So I clicked on this. This is on Tubi. I clicked because it was called Dance or Die. Now, Lady Gaga had the song out, Abracadabra, and in the video, she opens it with, you may dance or die. And then as soon as she says that, like, badass dancing chaos ensues. This is not that. So I clicked because Dance or Die, with this like really cool cover of like shoes and blood and dance shoes and blood and stuff, implies that this is kind of a slasher. So I went in expecting murder rock, to be honest. And then that Troma logo appears. And as soon as that Troma logo appears and the music starts, it suddenly becomes, I'll say, much like a vinegar syndrome, where I become a little dubious of what I'm about to watch because it is a hit or miss. Sometimes I watch these early Troma films. This is from 1987,
Weird.
and I end up going, "Oh, wow, that was good." And then other times I'm like, "Oh, well, kudos for making that, sir. I don't need to see it again." So I went in kind of sketched out by it, but this is super low budget. This is very much a trauma film. It is not horror. So that was kind of my biggest shock is like 20 minutes in, I'm like, nobody's died, and this doesn't seem to be horror. This is
Their
straight kind
career will die if they don't
of
dance. That's the end of your dance career.
this is straight like 80s action. Like somebody saw a Sidaris film and said, can we do that, but about dance? And that is exactly what this is. They are trying to get that like Andy Sidaris level of like badass women, boobs, guns, but about dancers. And so that's really what it's gunning for, but somehow without a budget and like six camera angles. So the setup is that there is this dancer and he is a really good dancer and he's trying to get a dance troupe together to compete in this competition or this showcase. He's a recovering drug addict. And listening to him at the AA meetings talk about coke is hilarious, where he's like, and my roommate had a mountain of cocaine on the counter and I wanted to take a funnel and vacuum it up, but I didn't. And so yeah, his roommate is still a drug addict. And so he's trying not to fall back into that lifestyle. Additionally, his roommate is a big dealer. And so there's always these like really seedy like dealers and drug kingpins hanging around the apartment. His roommate fucks up at some point and the kingpin, the drug dealer above him, kills him. And at that point, all this coke goes missing. And the guy is like, I don't know where it is. I don't do coke anymore. I'm cleaning up my lifestyle. I'm a dancer now. I dance. That's what I do. But the drug kingpin is like, I know it's here in your apartment somehow. If you don't find it, we're going to kill you. And so he is trying to be a dancer, trying to get a troupe together for a competition, trying to turn his life around. He meets a really hot playmate whose boobs we're going to see multiple times in the movie. And so he's got a new girlfriend. All while he is being chased by this drug gang trying to find where the coke is. And so that is our setup. Now, in plot, that sounds pretty cool. And I gotta say, it is. And I don't know why, because the guns are literally people with like rubber guns, just kind of jerking them back at people. And then somebody will fall off a building. There is no blood, there is no smoke, there is a bullet sound and nothing in between. And, you know, all of the scenes are a single angle and a single angle, and everybody moves in and out like theater. And then it's punctuated with all of these dance numbers. Like there's actually really fun dance numbers in this, which are all shot when with one angle as like a proscenium stage. It's okay. They're long dance sequences from one angle. That's okay. I will deal with it. Now, here's where it gets even wilder. Anytime he goes to sleep, he has these like crazy dream sequences, which are also dance numbers. So he's having, that's where kind of the only horror element comes in, is he has these really wild nightmares, but they're also dance numbers. So yeah, this was just drama, crime, and like a really weird dance recital all put together. It def felt like repercussions of the kind of early 80s, more gritty musicals like Phantom of the Paradise and The Apple and Xanadu, stuff like that. Oh, but it's set in Vegas. And that's his dream, is he's making this like Vegas show review. And then there's this weird Eskimo who kind of almost acts like a spirit guide for him that comes up a couple of times. I don't really know how that one factored in. He's just kind of there. But anyway, I don't know how I made it through this whole movie, but I did, and it was surprisingly really fun in the process. So dance or die. SOV.
So we don't have
I usually don't watch SOV movies either. That usually kind of turns me off in the first 10 minutes, but I was in for the dance numbers. I'll watch anything that's like a dance horror, even if it's like a dance Andy Sidaris ripoff.
You're doing the work this week. You went from Russian, oppressive Russian cinema to SOV dance film. So,
Yeah. So
respect.
it's when I'm by myself. I could actually like click whatever I watch and I don't have to think, well, my son's still up. How many boobs are going to be in this? Like when I'm by myself, it's just like, oh, okay, well, whatever. I can, do dishes and watch copious amounts of sex or bleak Russian cinema.
For some reason, maybe watching those kind of movies I could have, but I remember when we were shooting and we would stop to watch something. We only did it a couple times because it really backfired. It would be like you're really tired. It'll be like the end of the weekend. We watched whatever that last Cronenberg was before the Shrouds, and we watched the new Argento. And all you could see when we watched the movie was the cover. All we could notice is how it was being covered, and it, so we couldn't even watch the movie. It'd be like, oh, medium, close, oh, and it was so boring as a result that it was almost like I can't watch movies during this because it was like a rewiring of your brain. But that could have been just those movies.
No,
So,
but on the actual shoot nights, like the day that I'm doing 12 hours, most of the time I don't watch stuff. I'll come home, I'll read a little bit, and then I just crash.
pass out, yeah.
The only thing that I have been watching that has kind of been fun, on those shoot nights is The Traitors. So,
Yeah, TV makes more sense because it's
which is
shorter
just
form.
kind of mindless. It's not mindless, it's fun, but it's not affiliated in anything that we're doing. And I'm not doing that thing where I'm sitting there exploring it for coverage or shots or, well, that was cool. Hold on, I should do that. Let me rewrite my shot list for tomorrow. So yeah, it's I find when I was shooting Glorious, I remember watching a ton of Great British Bake Off. And that was like I binged two seasons while shooting that. And it was just like it lets you kind of turn your brain off and separate a bit.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of
Yeah.
sense. Okay, my next one was also pretty fun, in the same vein as these others, but I had never seen this one, which surprised me. This is Jess Franco, but it's not a typical Franco. So it's not like Venus and Furs, where I was like, wow, this is a beautiful and amazing movie. This was on the Video Nasty list for years, and for some reason, I think I even owned this on DVD and never watched it because I just thought I knew what it was going to be, just pure gore fest. And this is Bloody Moon from 1981. And I just had never seen it. It is basically as close as he gets to an A to B normal slasher movie. Like it fits
Ooh.
all the American slasher models, a couple of giallo ones, except that Jess Franco can't help himself. So of course there's incest plot line. There is a scarred up, person, soap opera, melodrama, lots and lots of nudity. Like, so he's throwing in stuff that he has to do because that's what he makes. But in the same token, it does
Oh.
feel close to what could have been a hit, you know?
I remember the cover for this. I've never seen this, and I didn't even realize this was Jess Franco. I just thought it was
It's
like
got.
another slasher.
Yeah, I thought for some reason there's a German, I think it's called The Burning Moon, a German gore film that's famous for just being pure gore that I've never watched that I also own with a similar cover. But Bloody Moon is yes, it's she just picked up a cover to show you it. But it's a woman's face screaming with a buzz saw close to it. So it looks more like a Fulci image. And that image does pretty much happen. And that is probably the best moment in the film. So it opens in the past and like, a few years in the past, there's like a Halloween party or something. And there's this guy who has this big, I can't tell if it's a big scar or birthmark, but his half his face is covered in it. And it's obviously impacted his life. He has a hot sister who's out, gallivanting, and he is kind of left in the shadows. And he realizes, oh, maybe I can. I think he kills the guy that's flirting with this girl, and then he puts on his mask, like it's a Mickey Mouse mask, so that probably causes problems too. And then he tries to seduce her and gets her back to her house. She's ready to roll, and then she takes off his mask, and then she starts screaming, and then he starts. I'm pretty sure he kills her. I can't remember if he kills her, but either way, it then cuts to he's been in a mental asylum for a few years, and now it's the day he's being released back into his sister's custody, and they're like, I think he'll be fine now. Don't worry, just don't get them all excited. And so he goes off to stay with her at a language academy, which is all hot girls studying Spanish in this language academy. And like, so they're all learning, some have come from other countries to learn Spanish, and he's meant to just hang out there while there's a villa on the top of a castle kind of thing where
So that sounds very Argento.
yes, this has everything, a little dash of everything. And then a sex maniac, a masked killer, very giallo masked killer
That
in this
sounds
case.
very Argento.
Yeah, is ki exactly without the style. That's the thing. Franco throws in stuff that's stylish, but he hasn't got like a unified style the way Argento does. So somebody's killing these, but a couple of kills are brutal. There's a brutal one, which I don't think I've ever quite seen this. A girl is, she's topless. She's stabbed in the back and the knife blade comes out through the nipple. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah, I know. It's pretty nasty.
That sounds giallo.
It does. No, it definitely has shades of that. And so it's got stuff in that's definitely entertaining. You obviously assume it's got to be him, right? But maybe it's not, because like towards the end, he's like, is he the killer or could somebody else be doing this, kind of using him as an excuse? He has a thing with his sister that he's kind of sexually obsessed by his sister and she's over him. And then there's all these other women going through. But again, this one's really weird too, because it starts with him and her as the characters. And then you get to the school and now suddenly it's just a random girl you're following for most of the rest of the movie. And you're like, okay. So again, it doesn't stick much to a normal structure, but I would recommend this. I think this is, if you're allergic to Jess Franco or something, this would be a good way in, because it's the closest to things you're used to watching. Even though, like I said, Venus and Fur straight up masterpiece, in my opinion, like blew me away as a movie compared to this. This is definitely much more of a, and I like things like Faceless. I've seen other Franco films. I just have never, this wasn't purposeful that I was watching this right after watching the other one. This just happened to be what popped up for me. I would recommend it. I think it has some pretty cool stuff. And the buzzsaw towards the end, it does kind of more or less deliver with that scene from the cover. So a decent one. I definitely deserves to be on the video nasty list from that period. Like if a movie should have been, it makes sense that it was one of them. And I think it was banned in Germany till like just the last couple of years. Like it's been long banned in some countries. So that's Bloody Moon by the Franco.
Digging your Jess Franco deep dive as of
late. It wasn't purposeful, but maybe I'll do another one.
Yeah. No, he's got some bangers in there that, and many of which I am missing as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to take us from Jess Franco to definitely not. But still, this was very watchable. So this is The Devil's Pass from 2013. Mm. And I'd had this on my list for a long time, but we did Snowbound Horrors for our cheat sheet this month, because I'm in the middle of very, very snowy Canada. And so this one keeps coming up. Anytime I'm like searching for Snowbound Horrors, this one kept coming up. So I wanted to watch it just to see how they're shooting the snow. And this is 2013 Rennie Harlan. Now, I was fascinated about this for another reason as well, because it's supposed to be a kind of newer version of the Dyatlov Pass story, which is real. So do you know the Dyatlov Pass story?
Tell me and I'll tell you.
Okay. So this is like a real story, unsolved mystery. We had covered this back when we were doing Blumhouse.com, and I've read books on this, and it's just kind of a fascinating story across the board. In 1959, a group was formed as like a skiing expedition across the northern Urals in Soviet Union Russia. And it was 9 grad students plus a couple of guides that went along with them, a couple of mountain guides. And they went deep into the mountains as like a research expedition. In a couple of days, and all of them were really experienced. All of them were very experienced in this environment. They were students. They knew what they were doing. A few days later, all of their bodies were found with their tongues missing, internal bleeding, chest trauma, tents ripped open from the inside, like not unzipped, like they ripped themselves out of their tents, skull cracks. Some of them died from hypothermia when they still had tons of wood, means by which to light a fire, and they could have gone back inside the tents. And supposedly, and this one's been disputed, some of the bodies even tested positive for radiation. And so this was a real thing. It happened. There's amazing books about it. And it's one of those unsolved mysteries of what really happened to them. And of course, there's bajillions of theories, everything from Soviet bomb testings, which is what most people kind of go with now, is that there were Soviet bomb testings, which would have kind of equated for all of the different kind of body injuries that they had. Yetis, avalanches, sonic weapons, you name it, it has been floated out. Russia still lists their cause of death as undetermined. Okay, now back to our movie. That's like the real story. Back to our movie. In this, it is a found footage film about 5 Oregonian college students who decide to find out what happened to those 9 hikers. Okay, so it is a found footage documentation. They're supposed to be making a documentary about, they're going to go to the Ural Mountains and retrace the steps of those hikers to find out exactly what happens. And I will say the first act of this movie was dry because it's all about them making the documentary and who's going to do what, and then getting to Russia and going to little towns and saying what they're going to do. And we're looking for guides that can take us into the mountains, and we need a ride to this town. The actual getting there was really dry. Like, I wanted them to pick up from, we're making a documentary about the Dyatlov Pass and we're here. And that would have been exciting. So the first half of the first 30 of the movie, I was kind of like, can we just
travelogue?
Yeah. Can we just get to the fucking site? Because nothing scary is going to happen on the way there. And it doesn't. Right. But finally,
that would kind of defeat the purpose if it was super creepy just getting to the pass. And then you get to the pass and nothing happens. It's like, oh.
I need the villagers from Dracula, like when they're in town, who are like, oh, you don't want to go there. Dead things are there. No, no one will take you there. It wasn't that. Yeah. It was very much like, yeah, I'll give you a ride for $20 type stuff. So fine, they finally get to the Dyatlov Pass. And that's where the movie gets good. Like, weird stuff starts happening. Like, it starts with compasses don't work and watches don't work and everybody's having fucked up dreams. And then they wake up one morning and there's all these footprints around the tent, but they didn't put them there. Eventually, they find a door buried in the snow that has been locked from the outside, meaning that they sealed something in. I'll stop there because that's when the movie like really picks up. This was fun for a found footage film. This was fun. Like, Rennie Harlan, you could tell, was like swinging hard with this. And so, is it the best acted? No, the drama's kind of meh. Involved in that first act of getting there is also like, who's fucking who is invested, who is just doing it as a job, who's going to drop the camera as soon as the shit gets real and take off. Like, the first act is pretty dry. But once they get to the site, this got fun. Does this answer questions of what actually happened in the Dyatlov Pass? I don't think so. Fuck no. But it brings in some really cool stuff. Like, there's some really kind of out there, wild, big swings in the third act that I really kind of enjoyed. I don't think it's breaking open the door on the case by any means, but some really fun approaches once it gets into that third act. So I ended up enjoying this. And then the last one I covered was also a found footage film because of this. Do you have another one?
I've got one, but why don't you add that one and then I'll end with this one.
Cool. Yeah. So then after I had watched this, and I watched this on, I want to say this was Amazon. I rented this. And so, because afterwards, whatever platform I was on, I want to say I paid like $2.99 and rented this on Amazon. I did, because it followed up with this one. It immediately does the, if you enjoyed blank, you may also enjoy blank. And it prompted me for a 2018 British found footage film called Webcast. And this also was $3 on Amazon. And I'd never heard of it before, but I looked on Letterboxd and it had really good rankings. And the reviews were really positive. So I was like, okay, let's go in. I will start with the fact that even though it's called Webcast, it's not a webcast. No one is casting shit to the web in this movie. It's, again, two people making a documentary, which is where most found footage comes out of. I enjoyed this one far more than I was expecting to. This was literally kind of like a secondary click for me just because I was prompted to after watching Dyatlov Pass, or The Devil's Pass is what the movie's called. But I ended up enjoying this far more than I thought I would because it goes folk horror. It is about a girl and her kind of situationship boyfriend who go back to her hometown and decide to make a documentary about her aunt. Her mom still lives in the house that she grew up in. And when her mom was about 16, her older sister, who was kind of the sparkle of the neighborhood, walked out the door one morning and completely disappeared. She was never seen again. Nobody had a clue what happened to her. There was just nothing. It was just as if she vanished off the face of the earth. And so this girl has gone back home now that her mom is like in her 60s and has gone back home to make a documentary and try to figure out what could have happened to her aunt when she was a child. Like, how did she disappear? What happened to her? And a lot of the people who are in this neighborhood, it's very old British neighborhood, very kind of back, not backwoodsy. It's a neighborhood nonetheless, but it feels very small town, Britain, like very kind of villagey. A lot of the people who were in the neighborhood when she disappeared are still there. They were kids when it happened, but they now live in their parents' houses or live just down the street. So a lot of the townsfolk are still there. And she's interviewing people to try to figure out what happened. This got wild. This was another one where the first act, I was kind of like, And we'll see where it's going as they're like interviewing neighbors and run surveillance. And they start seeing that people are watching them, that people are following them around. And then weird things start happening. Like there's a young girl who lives next door now with her parents, who they find outside in the cold, freaking out one night. And the parents are like, oh, she's a drug addict. We're going to get her back inside. But she's screaming for help and to get away from them, and something's wrong. This goes full fucking folk horror by the third act. Like somebody on Letterboxd called it Blair Witch and the Blair Witch meets the Wicker Man. I'll say that's not like it's not as great as either, but tonally, that's kind of a good comparison because it is kind of this documentary where you think that you're just doing like a crime investigation and then it goes full folk horror, complete with a third act full of A24 naked old people. So if you're into your naked old people that appear in every A24 film, hey, this has a bunch of them in the third act when it gets like full folk horror. But yeah, this was it did have a weird tacked on ending. I'm gonna say the film ended, it cut to black, and then 30 seconds later, like I'm about to click off of it, this weird tacked on 10 second ending comes up that I was like, wow, that felt like a producer note. It felt like they had done a test screening and everybody was like, well, that was a downer of an ending. And then they were like, oh, we need something else. And so yeah, it did have this like weird tacked on ending. But that said, I enjoyed this on both a found footage level and a faux car level. So that was called Webcast. It's not a fucking webcast from 2018.
Okay, I'll round out real quick because I have to get to work.
Oh, yeah.
But that's okay. If you are like me and you grew up watching Melrose Place, but always wondered, what would this be like? Directed by Tobe Hooper. I have a movie for you. So on Pure Cinema, we do a thing at once a year or whatever, a couple times a year, where we call it Director Missing Pieces. We pick a director who we love and realize, oh, here's a movie of theirs I never saw, and we fill in the missing piece for ourselves. I thought I was down to one Tobe Hooper movie left, which is his first film, Eggshells, which I'm purposely not watching until I can see it on a big screen someday, just because I know it's not going to be like amazing, but it'll probably be interesting. But it turned out there's one more, and I've called from 99, a Showtime movie called The Apartment Complex. And I had definitely not heard of this one. I was like looking at it going, wait, Chad Lowe is the star, Rob Lowe's younger brother. He is a psychology grad student in this thing. He really kind of Mr. Nice Guy. And he's like, I need to get a part-time job. The only thing like watching rats in the mazes we study would be like getting an apartment complex manager job. So he goes to a Melrose Place looking apartment complex, weirdly enough, called Wonderview, which blew my mind because in my movie, the place they work is called Wonderview because when I was 12 or in eighth grade, where I lived in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania for the year, was called Wonderview.
Oh,
And so I
wow.
named it after, I always try to bring in the name Wonderview because I lived there. So it was very weird when I saw the neon. I was like, wait, what? Anyway, so he's this. Now he gets the job by just showing up. The guy instantly gives them the job. The guy who gives them the job is a doctor. His last name is Caligari. This is
Oh.
not a subtle script.
No.
This script is basically this movie, especially based on Toolbox Murder, which I think is like
I think
not
that's a
quite a
good.
masterpiece,
It's
but
good though.
it's top tier late Toby for sure. It's like a
No, that's
really
a
good.
good one.
So I know he could have taken the same material and made a dark, fucked up movie, but instead, this is basically like a dark comedy. It's definitely never a horror film. It's definitely more comedy. So he gets the job from Dr. Caligari, who turns out to be not really the person he said he was, believe it or not, with a name like that. He gets in there, and then there's just it's a normal place to live. Like, you know, the tenants are just like Amanda Plummer, Patrick Warburton, Arlie Emery, Tyra Banks.
Harley Emery,
Arlie
okay.
Emery. So your Full Metal Jacket meets Tyra Banks. Tyra Banks, who's a kickboxer in this.
Of course she is.
Charles Martin Smith kind of hidden in there. Patrick Warburton's genuinely very funny. I mean, he's always funny. He's what's he the voice of the Tick? He's the Tick in the show The Tick. He's just a very funny actor.
Spoon.
He gets to notice. Yeah, he gets. Yeah, exactly. He gets to meet all these weirdos. They all have different relationship. Apparently, what is it? Frank Gehry is the big architect, right? They're like, this is an original. This whole complex was designed by Frank Gehry's brother. Iggy, one of the lines, and so everything's kind of off. So Iggy Gary somewhere must exist. Anyway, so it's not without its merits. And actually, nothing Toby does in this, I would say, is wrong. I think it's just like the script is so general. The interesting thing about it feels way, 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 way more like a pilot for a goofy, weird, late 90s TV show than it ever does a movie. And if you told me it was a pilot, I'd be like, oh, okay. I mean, it's dumb, but it's kind of fun. The hook, though, is so he's the manager of this place. You meet all the weird characters. No one cares. There is a pool in the middle of the courtyard that is completely green and grotesque, and no one's obviously been swimming, and everyone just acts like it's no big deal. And on his first day at the job, he takes out the scooper. He starts messing around in the pool, and he pulls out a big body of the guy who had his job before him, completely bloated and grotesque. They pull out the body, and now he's the main suspect because the cops are ridiculously dumb in this, and the cops are like, clearly it's you. It's like, this guy's been dead before I even got this job. Like, what are you talking about? So it's all kind of ridiculous. It's pitched in that place where it's meant to be kind of ridiculous and goofy. And slowly he's trying to prove his innocence. He's got a crush on one of the tenant girls who's with a kind of violent guy, Patrick Warburton. Clearly one of the tenants is not who they say they are, and bad things are happening. There's a giant snake at some point that gets into the compound. A lot of bizarre things, but none of them really hold together. It's a little goofy by the end, but also kind of charming. Like, I gotta give it props. Like, it wasn't a bad, like, it was like, oh, you know, Toby's good with humor. I think he's a good director of humor. So it's not like essential. It's more like in that vein of like completionist. This is definitely not horror to Hooper, but it shows what, you know, what he could do. And there's a couple funny things about it and kind of goofy, but this is one I'd never seen. I'm pretty sure your only way to see it would be an SD copy on like YouTube or somewhere. But it was for Showtime, so, you know, it could have been a show. The Apartment Complex, it exists as a movie by Toby Hooper from 99. It's real. Tyra Banks, people.
Tyra Banks. It looks like it's got Rachel True in it as well.
She is the female love interest, and she's good in it. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I like her just as a person. Yeah. So yeah.
Actually, she's not. No, she's Tyra Banks' roommate. And then the girl whose love interest is the redhead, who's in lots of movies. I've forgotten what her name is. She's a good actress. Forgot her name. But, like, it has a big cast. But it was just funny when it's Arlie Emery and you're like, and Amanda Plummer, who's always a little wild.
I totally buy that they would all be in the same apartment complex. Los Angeles, tracks. Yeah. It's L.A., yeah.
This as a double with Toolbox in a theater would be pretty cool because it would show Toby doing the apartment thing twice, but one time, you know, disturbing and scary, and one time more Melrose Placey. But yeah, not a home run, but you know, an interesting discovery. So definitely makes sense
Toby.
It makes sense on this one. But yes, I better run to work.
I will replay our hits from tonight. So we've got Death Screams. We have Midnight, 1982 edition. Dead Man Letters. I'm sorry ahead of time. Dance or Die, 1987. Bloody Moon, the Jess Franco one. Apartment Complex from 1999. The Devil's Pass from 2013. And Webcast from 2018. It's not a fucking webcast. Okay. Nice. So yeah, we had some good
next
hits.
Time we'll probably be in not in person, but like on.
I'll back be back in country, LA. Probably. So yeah, we will probably not be posting another Deep Cuts until the very, very end of February. February, like the 28th or so, right when I get back into LA. And hopefully by then I will have watched some new stuff. I have been jonesing to go to the theater. I ended up not making it yesterday, but I really want to go see Black Lung because I really enjoyed the video game it's based off of. I know you didn't play it. So I'll know fill you in.
I just know it's a YouTuber who's in the movie. And Travis Stevens just watched it and said it was actually pretty good. So I saw his review of it and I was like, okay.
It's but sci-fi.
I want to see Send Help. Send Help is what I want to see.
I've heard that one's absolutely bonkers. And a bunch of my crew went to see it yesterday and loved it. So I'm
Sam's
hoping.
The man.
Yeah, really another hit. Excellent.
Right,
we'll get to some movies this week and next, and we'll see y'all in a couple weeks. Thank you so much. Have a safe drive to work.